Hi folks, I'm Simon Ward, your host for this weekly podcast. Over the years, I've come to realise that achieving one's goals as a triathlete is not possible unless you support this with good nutrition, excellent recovery, develop a robust framework through mobility and strength training, and have a happy, balanced work and family life. Each of these elements contributes to our race day performances and gives us the best chance of turning those dreams into reality. Each week, my goal is to introduce you to the experts and thought leaders in each of these fields to help you squeeze the most from your life and enjoy racing success. So, without further ado, let's crack on with this week's guest. Today, I'm joined by Elliot Smales. Now, Elliot's a Yorkshireman. He lives in Leeds. He's originally from Barnsley, and he is one of the most exciting new talents in British triathlon, particularly at the middle and long distance. I'll just give you a rundown of his recent history in those two distances. Moved up to the 70.3 distance 2 or 3 years ago. He's had victories at Staffordshire 70.3, Dublin, Weymouth, and earlier on this year, he was also victorious in Sweden. He's been to the Ironman 70.3 World Championships twice, most recently in Nice this year, where he was 20th overall, but he did take the scalp off Patrick Langer, which would probably have been nice for him at the time, and he'll tell us a little bit more about that, no doubt. But after that, because that wasn't the end of his season, Elliot then went across to Spain to race at Ironman Barcelona, and he had the fastest debut Ironman by a British triathlete in a time of 8:01. So fantastic to have you here, Elliot. Thank you for coming.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
We've been trying to line this up for a while, haven't we? And like with a lot of your colleagues and peers, we have to try and align it with end of season and not clashing with other sponsorship duties that you have. So do appreciate you taking the time. So let's talk about how you started off in triathlon. I mentioned that you were originally from Barnsley. So Sheffield Triad, I guess?
Yeah, Sheffield Triathlon Club was where I first started getting into triathlon. It was more being dragged along to events with my dad and, well, just watching him swim around a lake or something like that while I just messed about. I was just a swimmer at the time and I swam for Rotherham Metro and then started getting taken to more and more of these events and got a bit older and it was like, well, if I'm going to be sat here for an hour, I may as well have a go. So I started out with a bit of aquathon, swim runs and, yeah, absolutely hated running at the time and, yeah, eventually went into triathlon at about, it's quite late probably, maybe 15 when I did my first one.
Quite a lot of the athletes that compete at the level you are seem to have a swim background. Do you think that's sort of the sort of background that you need to stand you in good stead as a triathlete?
At the shorter distance, at the top level, I think it definitely is like it's hard to get into it. It's hard to get into swimming later in life just with it being such a skill sport rather than something like aerobic running and biking where you can just sit there and pedal away or run for miles. But yeah, I think starting off as a swimmer really helped me start to do well in the sport quicker than if I'd maybe not, I suppose. So that's what probably kept me involved in it after I'd tried it. I thought, oh, I'm coming out of the swim like first and maybe I'm quite good at this. But then, yeah, everyone was flying past me on the bike and the run, so I needed to work out what to do there.
Yeah, you do pick up some important skills when you're young, don't you? There's no doubt that it's easier to pick up those skills that are required for efficient swimming. But also, as a time when you're growing, there isn't a great deal of stress on your body like there is from running. So you're not likely to pick up as many injuries, but you're still stressing the cardiovascular system. So that oxygen transport network is developing as your body's growing. And you see swimmers, they tend to have a broader shoulder, a bigger chest capacity. They've got that an efficient heart and lungs. And of course, if you want to be an endurance athlete, that's really what you need.
Yeah, I think it's a bit unheard of now. Like every swim session I did when I was a kid, so I think I joined Rotherham when I was about 8 and then swam with them up until about, well, 17, 18, till I came to university. The majority of my swim sessions were two-hour sessions. I never did any short, and I think that's probably played quite a big part in why I'm quite good at endurance now, because I would not dream of trying to get around a two-hour swim session now. I'd be absolutely blowing. But yeah, every swim I did back then was 2 hours, and 2 hours of like hard aerobic work can, yeah, really build you up.
I as you train down at John Charles as I do, and we're often in the same sessions or in the pool at the same time. And as I come onto the pool side at 7 o'clock and I see these little kids walking off, you know, they're 9 or 10, they're probably going through exactly what, because I know they've been in there since 5 a.m. they're probably doing exactly what you've just described at that age. And I'm, when we do our 2 hour sets and I think how I feel, and they've all got to go to school as well.
Yeah, I was actually never really good enough to make it into like the top level of swimming with Rotherham. Like, I think just other people developed earlier, and I think that's a big thing for swimming. Like, if you go through a growth spurt and you're suddenly 6 foot, which I've still not reached yet, so maybe next year. But yeah, I never made it good enough to get to the top level of swimming. So luckily, I never had to do any mornings before school, but it did mean all my sessions were quite late at night. So I'd be swimming up until like 9 o'clock, coming home and then having tea. But I think stuff like that helped me get into a good routine before moving to university, because sometimes I'd be swimming up until 9 at night, getting to bed about 10, and then I'd be riding to college the next day or something like that. So yeah, it got me into a routine of training before and after stuff and fitting it in around other priorities, yeah.
I also think that when you swim a lot, all you've got for stimulation is either the end of the rep, or and you're just constantly looking at that black line on the bottom of the pool. So you learn to focus on the things, you learn to switch off from the boredom. And I remember speaking to Jodie Swallow about all the athletes we used to sponsor at CompuTrain, and nearly all of them were ex-swimmers. And she said, yeah, because they can handle being on a turbo trainer for a couple of hours and it doesn't bother them. They're able to sort of push through that. Do you think that's set you in good stead as well?
With the monotony? Mentally for swimming, yeah, it is quite monotonous, but I'm absolutely dreadful on a turbo trainer, to be honest. Like, I'm struggling to sit there for more than 30 minutes before I'm really wanting to get off. But yeah, mentally with swimming, it's helped. Like, if you really get into a session, like, you start hitting times and it's consistent and you really focus on that session, then you'll look up and it'll be done. And I think that's part of just being strong mentally. You can get through stuff quite quickly when you're really invested in it. I don't know whether that's the same with a turbo. Maybe I'll have to try and really get into a turbo session, but that's what I really struggle with.
Well, I think it's, you know, the sessions are often written the same way. You've got your warm up and then you've got a drill set that might sort of transition into some sort of building of intensity. Then you've got your main set and then you've got your cool down. What I see with a lot of age groupers is they're looking at the set towards the end first. There's three or four different options for them to go through first before they get there, and yet they're already focusing on what have we got at the end. And so I think they're always looking for that. How many more of these have we got to go? If you just focus on, right, I've got to do a warm-up of 600, then we've got to do these 10-50s drills, and then when you get to the main set, you break it down into little chunks. You know, learning that is definitely an advantage when you come to racing Ironman.
Yeah, that would probably help, actually. I remember back in swim club now, we'd have a set written on a board, and then the coach would spin the board around and there'd be a second side of the board, so you wouldn't actually know anything else was coming. You just think, oh, this session's going to finish quite early, we might be going home a bit early. But no, that didn't normally happen, to be honest. So maybe that'd be something to try on the turbo actually as well, rather than have someone write it for me and then you've got this bit to come as well, turn it around. But yeah, mental resilience has been a massive thing in Ironman, especially in the first full that I did. Like, I don't think, it was pretty much 7.5 hours of wanting to stop, so it took a bit to get through that with my head. Yeah.
Which was the bit you didn't? It took you 8 hours. So if it's 7.5 hours, I wanted to stop. Which was the bit you didn't want? The first 30 minutes.
Well, 30 minutes of swimming was all right, and then after 30 minutes of swimming, I thought, "Oh, this is more than I normally race at." And then we had another 15 minutes of that to go anyway. Yeah, and then all of the run was probably the worst thing I've ever done.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think Alistair said the same thing about his experience in Kona, didn't he? It's the worst 2 hours of his life.
Yeah.
And given that most of the races up to that point that he'd done were never 2 hours anyway.
Yeah.
Well, we'll come back on to Ironman Barcelona in a bit. But you were at Sheffield Tri. Who were the personalities that were in the club that we might have heard of then, and who were inspiring you?
Well, like we said, it was Dan Brooke was probably the best person there when I was there. I know, trained a bit with like the GB squad and stuff like that. And I remember him. One day, I didn't really know him. He was kind of a bit older than me, but at the local swim run, I was doing the junior, or the club event, the swim run, and he came back after finishing the race, and he was on his cool down while I was still going. And I remember it was like super windy, super rainy, and he was like running in front of me to block all the rain and wind and help me get back, because I was absolutely shocking at running at the time still. And yeah, that was quite nice. And then it was mostly just, I kept going because it was more of a social group. Everyone was a bit older than me. There wasn't really a junior division like there is now though. But yeah, it was more just a social of like everyone had a laugh and everyone did this bit of sport, and then we all had chip buddies or something like that. And I think that's what's kept me in it. Like, I still meet up with them now every time I go home.
That's a proper Yorkshire way of doing sport, isn't it? I know quite a few fell runners that are over in Keighley Way, and actually most of them are in Bingley Harriers, who Alistair and Johnny occasionally run for. And their thing is to meet up at a pub, go and do a fell run, then meet back at the pub again and, you know, have a couple of pints afterwards. Yeah. It seems to be a much more relaxed way of going about it, but it doesn't seem to harm the performance at all.
No, I think it keeps you interested in it as well, like the social side of it and other people being there. It keeps you turning up. Like, you don't, if it's a training session, you don't want to let people down. You make sure you get there, and then you're actually excited to go and race, not just for the race, but because you're having a laugh with your mates as well.
Yeah, but very interesting, particularly with you racing at the pointy end, but still being, you know, appreciative of that social side. Is it sort of quite an interesting lesson? So you were, I think you were in Yorkshire Academy, weren't you?
Before you came to
Leeds?
I think I attempted a few when I was getting into it a bit more, and I did a couple of sprint triathlons, just local ones in Doncaster. And then we looked at like how I could get into junior races and race people my age, because like I said, there wasn't anyone in the club around my age. And so we started traveling like over Yorkshire to do the series, and then eventually started chatting to people and realized that there was a collective meetup for young people in Yorkshire, probably like once a month normally, I think we met. Just to train. So I did some trials up in Leeds. I think I had to do a swim and a run. It age dependent. I think it's up to like 400 meters and 3000 meters on the track. But yeah, got through the swim pretty well and scraped myself through on a run that they thought it was worth investing a bit of time in me. So luckily I got to get onto the Yorkshire Academy squad and meet up with some other people who were more my age and start entering some other races.
Yeah. And then from there, did you come to Leeds as a student then?
Yeah, I moved up to Leeds in 2013 as a student. One of the coaches on the academy was actually the coach for the development squad for the universities. So
who was that?
It was Rob Harvey at the time.
Okay, yeah.
And I had some involvement with Manchester Tri as well. And so I moved up here, trialled again. It's a lot of trials when you're moving up these ranks, but trialled again and managed to make it onto the development squad in Leeds, which was like under the performance squad, which obviously you've got Ali, Johnny, Tom Bish, I think Dave Mack was on it at the time, non Stanford. And then, yeah, spent 4 years training and living in Leeds on that squad.
You didn't move out of the development squad there, did you? You sort of decided to go up to doing 70.3 racing before you'd finished at university. What was behind that decision?
Yeah, well, the whole focus of the development squad was short distance racing. So we were racing the Super Series in Britain, any French Grand Prix you could get yourself into, and then hopefully you were good enough to do a couple of European Cups. I did manage to get into a few European Cups, but I don't think I was developed enough as an athlete at the time when I did so. So the results didn't really reflect what I think I could now achieve if I did the same races. And then, yeah, the centre got changed up a bit. The coach, well, Rob left with a year to go before I finished university. And then the new coach came in, obviously he wanted to more start like with the younger athletes that he was already coaching through the academy. So I was given a bit of free rein really, and with results not really going my way in European Cups, and I'd always wanted to go longer and always been encouraged not to, and like people had held me back, and I was kind of in a place where no one could really do that now. Like, I could kind of just do what I wanted. So yeah, I tried a year of 70.3 to start doing the Castle Series. I was already racing the Olympic distances there, so I thought, oh, I'll enter the middle distance instead. And I ended up winning, I think I won three of them that year. I entered three and won three. So I was like, oh, maybe I'm not used to winning stuff. Like, maybe there's something in this and I'm actually quite good at it. But yeah, that's how the transition kind of came along.
And so when did you take the plunge and enter your first international 70.3 then?
Yeah, so from winning three of the Castle Series races, that got me on the criteria of British Triathlon's criteria of turning professional for the next year, so that I could enter like Challenge, Ironman, bigger races. Ironman if you pay for your license, obviously, which we'll probably come into. But yeah, so the next year I remember I entered Challenge Rimini as my first ever pro race. Oh, actually, no, the year before I'd managed to get into a short distance, like semi Ironman pro race. It was 51.50 in Warsaw in Poland, and unexpectedly won that. So that was another bonus added onto the list that was like, well, if I've beat all these pros, then can I go pro next year for British Triathlon? But yeah, Rimini was the first 70.3 I did as a professional, and I don't think I've ever been as much of a wreck in my life, like the day before that race or the night before that race.
As in nerves?
Yeah, nervous. I've never really felt nervous before a race. I think because it was so early and it was like even scary. I was just in a place where I'd travelled, a couple of friends had gone out, but like no family there watching anything like that. I saw these people who were racing as like untouchable. I was just basically, I didn't want to come last. I was like, I just don't want to become like humiliated. And I'd not really raced, I'd obviously raced the distance, but only three times and only ever fully by myself, like solo. I'd never raced next to anyone. And I was going to race probably 30, 40 other professionals and do it right next to them. And I just didn't know how it was going to go. Yeah, it went quite well. And I ended up coming fourth in my debut, like, so.
Who were some of the pros? Anybody
yeah, so, like, Andy Boscher was in it, and yeah. He's, like, a pretty good level athlete.
Well, he's won Ironman Switzerland a few times.
Yeah, I was quite scared. Yeah. I was quite scared of him, and then
I think he's had a top 10 in Kona as well, so.
Yeah, Giulio Molinari, he'd been European middle distance champ. He was racing there, and it was an Italian race, obviously, as well. Thomas Steger, who's a young athlete, who's going quite well at the minute. Yeah, there were quite a few good guys there. There was an older Italian guy who used to be really good. I think he may be in his 40s now. I think he raced at the time. Massimo Sagana, maybe? Massimo Sagana raced, I think. But there were quite a few people there. Per Bittner was there, Van Vleuken's husband.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, understandably nervous, but fourth?
Yeah, fourth. Yeah,
and were you moving up through the field as you went into the run, or were you hanging on?
The bike was just, I had no idea what to do. I was just trying to keep a gap between myself and other people, like make sure I didn't draft, but I was hanging on to try and stay like with anyone. So it didn't really matter anyway. And then I got to the run and I thought, well, if there's anywhere I'm going to work through, it might be here. And I started picking off a couple, I think. And then I remember I had to run all the way to the line because I was picking people off the whole way through. So it was quite hard because you don't always have to race a full 21K. You might only race 10K sometimes and then be like, I can't be caught, I can't catch anyone. But yeah, this was one of them where you had to run 21K as hard as you could.
Is that on the same course or the same area where they have the Ironman Italy now? It's in that...
East Coast. Yeah, yeah, it'd be a similar place, yeah.
So it's reasonably flat, the bike, is that right? Or did you go inland?
We went inland up to near... Is it San Marino? We went up to there, I think, or like near it. So we had... It was like gradual rolling, climbing all the way out and then go around a nice little Italian village and come back down. That was quite nice, yeah.
You're quite small in stature. I think you were telling me that your racing weight's around 62, 63 kilos. So is a hilly technical course something that suits you?
Yeah, they suit me, but they're still just as hard. So sometimes, even though I'll go better over a hillier technical course, mentally it's still just as hard to keep going. Like, it's the same with the heat. It's hot for everyone. Yeah. You might be better in the heat, but it doesn't mean you think you're any better.
No.
You just struggle through it slightly quicker than everyone else.
But it is like the old phrase, horses for courses.
Yeah,
isn't it?
Exactly,
if you're on a flat course and you're riding against somebody who can push out 300 plus watts for 4 hours, you're going to be a bit of a disadvantage, aren't you? Really?
Yeah, especially on like some of the shallower gradient descents when the bigger guys accelerate quite quickly because they weigh maybe 10, 15 kilos more, and then them rolling a big gear is a bit easier than me doing it. And they're the bits where, so normally when most people are working hard, like up a hill or trying to hang on, I've got to work quite hard on the descents, which is odd, and most people would hope to take a rest there, but I sometimes have to work quite hard uphill and downhill.
How did you go in Nice this year, the World Championships? Because that's, you know, watching that live on Facebook, that was a technical descent, but a long drag climb. That wouldn't be strange to you, would it, living around here?
No, I'd ridden the climb four times as well. I went out there for 4 days earlier in the year and managed to ride the course every day I was there. So I was quite familiar with the climb and the bits that were hard. I was actually, I think I was maybe a minute and a half, 2 minutes down on what I'd ridden the climb in training than I'd performed at World Champs. But I think that might, it's conditions of the day and wind and stuff like that. It didn't feel a quick day going up there. I think it was more of a headwind. The bike, I think it was a race where I feel like I did most of the stuff right and didn't get rewarded for doing the stuff. So it was almost like I needed an extra 1% every time I did something right, and I'd lose everything by fully committing to it. So the first bit of the bike, coming out of the swim, I lost the pack, which had Starkovitz and some other stronger riders in.
I knew
if I got through the first, I think it was about 7 miles, that's when the steep climbs started, which were over 20%, and I knew I could get back on there, and I managed to stay just behind that group to that point. But I'd ridden 7 miles pretty not in the pack. I was 30 meters off the back instead of 12 meters off the back. And then it ended up being Langer at the back. And I thought, I don't want to take him into this pack because he's a good runner. Whereas I wasn't as scared as the other guys in the pack about running. So I think I left it a little bit late to go around him. And by the time I had, the group was then 25, 30 metres in front on a very hilly section, which time-wise compared to a flat section is probably going to be double. And I think at that point it was just, I should have gone round him earlier. And then he got dropped straight away, and then it was just me watching a group of 4 or 5 strong bikers ride away. And then you've got about, I'd say, I think it was 20 miles to the bottom of the proper climb. So I had a good 10 miles by myself then, trying to ride up shallow drags that you'd been better having a big powerhouse in front of you for. And then at the bottom of the main climb, I saw the third big group on the road, it probably would have been, catching me. So I settled into the first K, it was quite easy. And then after that, I think you had 7 or 8K or whatever at 7% or something like that. But then when this train rolled past, it turned out to be the likes of like Kinlay, Rudy Wild, George Goodwin was in there, and I'd been on the training camp out there with him. So I knew he was capable. I think when we did the effort up there, he dropped me by 15 seconds. Over like 9K. So I was like, I'm capable of riding with him, but it just hurts a lot. I think there was another couple of bikers in there. Forget his name now. Maurice Clavell was in there. And then Rudy Wild, I don't know if I've already said him. And we started picking, I managed to stay in the middle of that group, about third. And we started picking off like rider after rider as we went up the hill. And I thought, I'm in here, like this is good. And then 1 mile from the top of the hill, Kinlay rolls to the front, and he's just like mashing the pedals. I'm like, and I slid back to the back of the five. The 3 or 4 we'd already caught had gone straight out the back, so we were obviously shifting. And I think I averaged about 300 watts, I think, which is the highest power I'd done up that climb for 30 minutes. And I don't know what Kinlay was pushing. He was pretty lean at the time, but it must have been nearer to 400. And yeah, so I lost the group coming over the top of that climb. I got caught by a couple of guys we'd passed on the way up and just had nothing to hold on to them. So I'd done all the work, I'd done all the effort. And then that last little bit where if I'd have just rolled over the top of them, I'd have had an easier ride. Because then picking lines through the technical aspects of the descent, you just let someone else make the mistakes in front and you pick a better line. And so you don't actually have to ride any quicker. You can just brake later and make it a better corner, make it a smoother line. But I didn't have that opportunity because I'd just let the group go again. Yeah. And then obviously being 62 kilos, like riding down, I wasn't accelerating very fast at all. And I could have done with someone a bit bigger.
You mentioned several times in there about being in the group. There'll be a lot of people listening thinking, well, this is supposed to be non-drafting. Yeah. So just, can you just explain how it is non-drafting. I mean, obviously there's some interchanges, people are rolling past, but you still have the draft marshals there. You still have to, is it 12 and a half metres?
12 metres, front wheel, yeah.
Yeah. So you've still got to abide by those rules and you're still going to get pinged with a draft penalty. But yeah. But there is some advantage to riding in a group, isn't there? Can you just explain a little bit more about what
it's riding? It's riding smart, and there's probably two aspects to it. And I'll point out now that I've never been done for drafting after having many a motorbike riding at the side of us. I sometimes actually ask the bike, is this distance okay if it's a referee? And normally you just get a thumbs up, or if they want it a bit bigger, they'll just...
Yeah, but the fact that they see you engaged and you're asking around, that's the thing. You're showing them that you're focused on the distance, aren't you?
It's quite obvious when people are trying to draft. Mm-hmm. You can see the certain bits where you have to be vigilant of what's coming up on the road. Like if you're going in from a downhill into an uphill, then yeah, obviously we're going to bunch up. But if you're vigilant and you're trying to hold the gap there, I think that's when the referees know you're fine. If you're willingly just riding into that gap and then coming out of it, then yeah, big no-no, that's drafting. But the two aspects of riding in a group, the first one, you can pace off other people. You don't have to be fully engaged and concentrating. It's not, I suppose it saves you a bit of like mental energy, but you might not be able to ride any quicker on the front. But you focusing on someone means you're engaged with the race still, and you're engaged at just holding that gap. You're not having to think about, I need to pedal harder, like, and focusing on pain. You're focusing on, right, I need to stay at 12 metres and we're going at a good pace. And then, yeah, the other bit of it is you're still getting a benefit at 12 metres. It's not, if you stick two bikes in a wind tunnel and see how much the guy behind's got a pedal, it's still going to be, there's a graph and a curve on it of watts you're saving. I can't remember what it was exactly, but I think it was like 30 watts or something at 12 metres. 30 watts to me is a lot of power.
Well, think about how much training and how many months it would take to gain 30 watts. Yeah. That's probably, and for people at your level, you know, 30 watts, you're probably not going to gain that, are you? Because you're already quite close to your ceiling. But for most age groupers, it would be at least a good year of hard work.
This is why you see the packs, because it allows, obviously not everyone's exactly the same level of rider, but it allows people within a range to ride with each other. If someone can push 300 watts out on the front and your max is 270, you could ride in the same group as them.
I suppose the worst thing, and you see, it's more apparent at Kona where you've got long stretches of sort of steady inclines, and you've got a group that contains seven or eight people. If you're at the back and you want to make some time up, if you pass one person, they're not going to drop back and let you pull in like you might do if you're overtaking a car. You've really got to commit to overtaking all of those eight people, and that...
This is the flip side of it.
That's going to take you 4 or 5 minutes of pushing out over 300 watts for you,
it's more.
As soon as you get to the front, they're all going to come back.
Yeah, this is the other side of it. It's not like you can just sit... Say there's five of you in a pack. You can't just sit fifth wheel and have an easy ride all the way around. If the guy at the front decides to accelerate up a hill, that takes time to get back to you, and the group will stretch. And the first place it's going to break... is at the back, or if someone breaks in the middle, you're also going off the back. And it's like, the rule is, if everyone's at 12 metres, you can't ride around one person and slot in, because no, that gap's 12 metres, you'd have to pass everyone in the group. Like, I've gone, I remember at Worlds last year, I tried to pass maybe four or five people uphill, because I thought it was quite easy, and I wanted to just be higher in the group, because it's safer, and you get less of that stretch. And it was a big effort just to get to the front, and then hopefully allow like one person back round to do some pacemaking. But yeah, it's not like you're just getting a free ride if you're playing the game in the group. But again, like people in races, like some pros, I don't think they really understand the tactics of it, and they ask you to come and do a turn. And if you're a faster runner than them, I don't understand why some people want to go through and do that turn. Like it's up to the faster biker who can't run as fast to do the effort to break themselves away. If they've put themselves in a position where they're with you on the bike, then they need to get out of that position and put as much time into you as possible on the bike.
It's not dissimilar to the breakaway in the Tour, is it?
No,
where they're coming into the sprint and you know you've got a guy there that can sprint and another guy wants him to do the work. Why would he waste some of his leg power to do a bit of a turn when he wants to win the stage as well, you know?
Yeah, and almost,
you're here, you work.
Yeah, doing a turn for someone else sometimes, or you're racing for second if that's what you're doing. But if I think I can outrun someone, then, and there's no one behind you I think's coming through who can beat us both, then yeah, I'm not going to roll through and give them a rest so that they've got more of a chance of beating you in the end.
I suppose one of the benefits of being at the front is that you can set the pace and you can stay fairly constant. And we know that if you're accelerating and decelerating to match up to what's being done at the front, you know, like you say, if somebody stands and puts some power down going uphill, or if there's a bit of a gap and you have to work hard to break it, that's less economical than keeping the same pace. And so, and you often see this in regional races, particularly Ironman, where somebody will win and they'll post a good time, but they'll never be able to replicate that performance in the World Championships. And that is because when they're in the regional race, they're in control of the pace and everything. And when they're in the World Championships, they're perhaps not in control and they're having to respond. And that takes a lot more mental and physical energy.
It's massively inefficient. Like my power profiles from races where I've been in a group. So Europeans was a good one last year. There's maybe five of us and there's a lot of 90 degree bends. And every time we'd roll into one, you'd be down to 0 watts because you couldn't take it any faster than 20 mile an hour. Every time you came out of one, I'd be up at 300, 350 watts for maybe up to like 30 seconds a minute, especially on some of the drags where the guy on the front had put the hammer down as well. In between that, I'd be dropping between maybe 175, 180. So it was so polarized when I looked at it after. But then you can compare that to when I won Staffordshire last year, I rode the whole thing by myself off the front. And the power profile, I carried probably better speed than the group behind. This is probably the only reason I won, is because I rode every little rise and little descent at a smoother profile than they will have done. And I could dictate my own pace. It's when someone's dictating the pace for you, it's what they're comfortable with and it'll play to their strengths. And what if they're better uphills, and that's where it'll be hard. If they're good at technical sections, that's where it's going to be hard for you if you're not. But when you're doing your own race, like at Staffs, I just rode the bits I was good at, I rode hard, and the bits where I could recover, I recovered. And I think that was probably one of the best rides I've ever done.
If you were doing an Ironman or a 70.3 where you knew there was going to be lots of turns and lots of that slowing down and speeding up, would you change your training to incorporate more efforts rather than steady state work?
Not really, because luckily I was already quite good at like sprinting naturally on the bike when I came to cycling. I don't know why, but that is, maybe it had come from the swimming and doing a lot of swim training. But sprint wise, I'm not too bad on the bike, and technically I'm not too bad. I think again, being small and low center of gravity helps with all that kind of stuff.
So it doesn't so I'd not change penalize my training. You and Julie.
No, I actually benefit probably when it's a bit technical, and as long as it's not super super steep downhill. But yeah, when it's technical and when there's a lot of accelerations, I seem to cope with it quite well and run off it all right.
And I suppose that when you were in the development squad and you were doing those shorter races, that is the sort of race you're in a group, and then the acceleration comes, then you're in a group.
It's not that long ago.
A lot of power peaks, aren't
there? Yeah, it's still only, 3 years ago that I came 70.3. So 4 years ago, I was training for sprints and Olympics, drafting races in a group in a bunch. And I still train now a lot with all the guys who are racing European Cups, World Series. So every now and again, I'll join in with one of their little chain gangs or something like that. And the peaks in power still transfer, I think, to Ironman. Fine, like I'm saying, I have to do big spikes in power when I'm doing 70.3. So I'm not going to stop training it just because most of Ironman riding is steady state.
You were preparing all year for 70.3. At what point did you decide you were going to race Ironman Barcelona?
When all my mates from Sheffield said they were racing and that there might be a bit of an end of season, a few beers in Spain. But yeah, it was never really on the cards until halfway through the year. And the thing is, because Worlds at the end of September, and then after I raced in Sweden and won the 70.3 there, that was the first qualification race for Topal next year. And
so is the 70.3 Worlds the same as Ironman now? That if you win a race, there's no points gathering?
No, one slot you go in unless it's a continental champs or a designated race where there might be two or three slots. But yeah, every race has got one slot. So I was planning to do 70.3 Worlds and then probably do a couple of 70.3s after like Weymouth, maybe even Lanzarote, something like that, to try and qualify for 2020. And then luckily, at the first race in the world, which was Sweden, which I went to, I won it. So then I had a slot by July. So it kind of left the back end of my year a bit like, oh, well, what do I do now? Like, I've achieved the goal that I'd set for the whole of September and October. So yeah, when the friends from Sheffield said they were racing in Barcelona, I thought, well, I've nothing to lose if I attempt an Ironman now. Like, I've got no plans for the rest of the year. It's going to be my last race. It can't really mess me up for any races after. So yeah, that's why I decided to have a crack at that.
That's interesting because, you know, I mentioned that you set the fastest ever performance by a British triathlete in a debut. You went 8:01. And yet it seems like there wasn't any specific Ironman training for this.
There was no specific Ironman training. Worlds was only, was it 3 or 4 weeks? I think it was 4 weeks before 70.3 Worlds. And like, I'd fully invested my year into that and then came away with not the result I wanted, but all my focus had been on that. So I think between 70.3 Worlds and Barcelona, I did a run that was like 14 miles, but broken up with a lot of stops and stuff like that. I didn't do anything. I don't think I did anything specific on the bike. I think I just kept it the same.
What do you average normally as a week's training volume?
So in winter's probably the best time because it's the most stable time of training. So I'll probably get up to like 30 hours and maybe hold that for a few weeks. And then I'll normally have a bit of an easy week after that. But yeah, run volume wise, I'll get up to probably 80 miles, but I won't sustain that for more than a week, 2 weeks, but I'll hover between 70 and 80.
Right. So what I'm really pointing towards there is whilst the volume, the typical volume that people might do for Ironman is there, it might not be very specific towards Ironman, but you're still getting the volume you need.
Yeah, the volume's still there. Like again, on the bike in winter, I'll aim for 250 miles plus a week. So it's still a good, maybe 15 hours on the bike, 13 hours on the bike, something like that. But yeah, it's not like I'm going out and doing 5 hour, like sub threshold rides in position and stuff like that. And I think they were the little things that I really struggled at with the Ironman. Like, after halfway on the bike, I was just so uncomfortable that I just wasn't riding the TT bike as it was meant to be ridden anymore. I was just sitting on the sides, couldn't sit on the skis, didn't want to sit on the saddle, everything in it. Yeah, I was just rolling about.
Yeah, that thing for Ironman is those long rides aren't necessarily about riding hard. It's getting your body used to being in that aero position for four and a half hours. Yeah. For most of us, it's 5.5 to 6 hours. But you can't, you know, no matter how fit you are on the bike, you can't replicate being on the bike for 5 hours.
Fitness never came. Like on the way back, I remember I was riding, if I rode on the skis, I couldn't go over 200 watts without it being too uncomfortable. But riding on the sides, I could ride at 250, so the legs weren't a problem. But I was going the same speed for whichever one I did. So instead of riding on the skis, I rode on the sides, did 70, 80 watts more, and just went the same speed as what I was going on the skis. But it was so inefficient that I was just losing time hand over fist by that point.
You're talking about your wattage there. I know a lot of people listening will be thinking, well, ask Elliot what his FTP is. I did the same with Alistair and it wasn't really an issue, but he said, oh, my FTP is around 400. What, do you know what yours is?
I did two tests last year. One of them I had a paddy and got off and nearly threw the bike out the window.
Standard.
Yeah, so I think it was something like 300 and... I did a 12-minute test, so it wasn't a 20. I think it was about 305, but that was on the extensions, on the skis in TT position. I imagine if I rode like a road bike on the sides, it'd probably be a bit higher, but I'm never racing at that. I never do sessions not on the skis. So there's no point really having the number for...
What would your power be, your normalised power for an Ironman?
It varied this year anywhere between, I think Europeans, even though it was like a 2.0 something or 2.10, sub 2.10 bike split, maybe something like that. I was at 225 or 220, but then some of the other like slightly hillier ones, I was up at like 250, 260, something like that.
What about Barcelona? What did you ride there?
Barcelona. First, I think I averaged 229. First lap was about 255.
That's interesting then. You were averaging more than you do for your 70.3.
Well, the first lap was, it was in the group and it was kind of like what I said about you accelerate, and I was doing big efforts like over 300 watts. And I thought, well, we can't do this for 4.5 hours because no one will be able to run after it. So yeah, I went through halfway in 207 So I was like, oh, that's faster than I've ridden at a half all this year. Still, alarm bells weren't going off at this point. And I think I'd averaged, yeah, about 250 watts, maybe a bit more, just because of all the spikes.
Mm.
And then, yeah, literally 4 miles later, it was like 60 miles. I was just, the lights in my legs just went out. I was like, oh, this is, we're only 4 miles into unknown territory and my body's already failing me.
Well, I suppose, you know, there was nothing to play for, was there? You were really going for an end of season party with your mates. You'd already achieved what you wanted to by doing the Worlds this year and qualifying for next year. You got nothing to lose.
Yeah,
experiment. You've probably learned quite a lot for the future.
Yeah, I made the swim break, and I think four or five of us got a little gap, and I thought, oh, excellent! Like I've done well there because I've not been swimming very well, and I actually swam quite well, and then we set off on the bike and thought, yeah, it's quite easy. And then I think Freddie Van Leerd caught us after about 5 miles, and then it stopped being so easy and got quite a lot harder. But yeah, I was in there, and I said I was either going to, I said before to the guys, I was like, I'm going to win or I'm going to DNF. Like that's how it, I was going to fully commit to just doing as well as I could in the race, or I wasn't going to finish it. Like, cause I was going to blow up, and the blow up kind of happened, but I somehow kept myself in the race. I don't know how I did it, but yeah, mentally I kept myself in it for another 4 or 5 hours after that.
So you said that you'd not run any more than 14 miles.
No.
Most of us, including me, you can get to 21K feeling okay. And it's just something like there seems to be a switch where your body starts to stiffen up. Your feet don't work as they normally do. You start shuffling. You start feeling a bit nauseous. And obviously then your head starts to go a bit. So once you'd got past 14 miles, you know, what was going through your head, and how do you keep yourself going through those bits?
Yeah, specifically with this run, I was pulling out with 40 miles of the bike to go still. I was literally riding because I was 40 miles away from where my kit was. So I knew I had to ride back to Kalea. So I was riding back and I started to feel a little bit better with about 5 miles to go. And I drank as much as I could. Every aid station, I was just getting in as much as I could after that, after the bonk, and just thought, oh, I don't want to feel rubbish all evening, like if we're going out for beers and stuff. So I'll sort myself out. And then, about 5 miles to go, I thought, oh, well, transition's a mile, about 1,500 metres from the finish. So I thought, oh, fans and like supporters who'd come with us, all will have like my kit and stuff to put on to get me water. And I thought, oh, they'll be stood down there. So I thought, I'll run 1,500 metres. I can manage that. And I set off, and I remember I'd been saying to all the guys in Leeds before I did it, I was like, I don't understand why everyone runs so slowly at Ironman. Like, it can't be that hard to run like a 2:30 marathon, can it? Or 2:40, no one does it. Because you look at all the marathon times people are doing now, and people are going, like club runners are doing 2:20s and stuff like that. You think, oh, well, surely.
Well, Booker did a 2:20.
I can beat a club runner. But yeah, then I understood at that point. But then I thought, oh, I've told the lads I'm going to run sub 2:40 here. And so I set off at like, I think I set off at 2:36 pace, something like that, after bonking. And I just thought, you want to stop? Why are you doing this? And I got down there and I thought, right, I can either stop now when I'd seen my dad and some friends. I was like, I can stop. All right, I'll just try a lap. I'll see how a lap feels. Like a lap's 14K, so I don't know what I was thinking at the time, because it's not like you can just see what it's like for a few minutes and turn around. So I set off on the first lap, and I think I averaged 3:40K pace for the first lap. So I was like, I held it for a lap. I was like, oh, I've kind of held what I told them I was going to do. And then, yeah, and then every lap after that, I just wanted to stop. But again, I was trying to, it was more just one foot in front of the other. Every aid station, I was absolutely rinsing. They had nothing. Like when I was getting there, all I wanted to do was stop and just stand there and drink stuff as long as I could. But I knew if I stopped, I wouldn't start again. So I just kept moving, grabbed as many cups as I could. I drank a lot of Red Bull, probably way too much. But yeah, luckily I'd put a special needs bottle on the course as well, which I'd recommend doing if you have the opportunity to do, just because you never know what state you're going to be in by that point. It might be like 7, 8, 9, 10 hours into your race. Like when you start that run, you don't know how bad you're going to be. So I remember I got past it on the first lap, and I thought, right, when you get there, next lap is a little mental reward. I was like, you can have the special needs bottle. So that probably kept me going a little bit. And then on the second lap, I took it. Made no difference anyway, but it had got me another 14K through the race. So, and then, yeah, I thought at the second lap, it was more just, well, if you get onto the last lap, you may as well finish it. Like, but at this point, I told myself I could run as slow as I wanted. Like, it didn't matter how fast I went. So I was like, just slow down, just run easier, like try and sort yourself out. It didn't really make much of a difference. And then you're torn between wanting to get to the finish as quick as possible and, well, yeah, just wanting to get to the finish as quick as possible, and the motivation of finishing it was the only thing that probably got me around.
You finished fourth, didn't you?
Yeah, I finished fourth.
That's pretty good. You're on the podium.
I took a couple of places back on the run, but
what was the winning time?
7:45. It was Florian Angert, yeah.
But 16 minutes isn't bad, given how rubbish you felt.
Oh, no, yeah. I remember Florian rode away from us at about 40 miles on the bike as well, so I'd not seen him for quite a good few hours, and I know how good of an athlete he is, and it was his debut as well, and everyone else probably underestimated him, but I kind of knew that he was either going to be the same as me, he was either going to win or he was going to explode. So, and when I saw him running, I thought he'd got it in the bag, really.
Who else was in front of you?
Freddie Van Leerd, which is not a bad name to be beaten by.
Not at all.
And then Nick Castelline, who I know does a lot of training with Frodo out in Girona, and it's like, what, 40 minutes from where he trains. So, yeah, local race that he's done before.
I'd say that was a pretty good end to the season, really.
Yeah, I think after I'd done it, I was like pretty happy with the result. It was probably up there with winning Sweden as like best result of the year.
And how were you for the party in the evening?
Shocking. I ate like half a pizza, felt horrible. I think I had one beer and then threw one away.
I can't remember which pro athlete he was. It was somebody from the 90s. I may be getting my stories mixed up now, but he had really bad cramp, such that he had to just grab hold of a tree to stand up, but he kept going. And somebody said, why are you keeping going? He says, never let anything get in the way of getting to the party after the race.
Yeah, it took me a good 30 minutes after crossing the finish line to stand back up again. I think I crossed the line and I was so gone. Well, obviously they were doing the presentation with the first three, so I was like the first one into the athlete's lounge with all the food and stuff like that. And I hobbled in there and I didn't make it into the lounge. I had to sit where they were giving the t-shirts out, and then a volunteer came over, and luckily one of the guys who used to be in Leeds when I came here for university now works for Ironman, and he'd managed to get in there.
Who's that?
His job, Jacob Marklew.
Okay.
He was setting up the event, and I think he was taking stuff down later on, so luckily it was free, and I got him to go outside and fetch my girlfriend in, because I wasn't going to stand up for a good half an hour. But I've never felt as sick in my life as that. I really struggling to stomach stuff after it, and yeah, just depleting your body in it. And
let's talk about the life of a triathlete outside of the training. Yeah, you came fourth in Barcelona. What was your official prize purse there, and what do you actually get of that in your hand?
Oh, Barcelona was, I think the win was 8. Second was 4, maybe 3, and then 2.5. So maybe about $2,500 prize money. Then take off that whatever percentage Spain withhold. I don't think it's too bad in Spain. I think it might be 25% or something
tax.
Like that. Yeah,
yeah.
It's tax. Yeah. So then you'll end up with, what, $1,750 maybe.
Do you pay for your flights to get out there?
Yeah, flights.
Do you pay for your hotel?
Yep.
So that's got, so to, come probably off, that's got to come off your $1,750.
Yeah, so you're on $1,750 transfer rate from international Ironman's bank in Switzerland back to Britain or whatever other bank you're using here. That'll knock a little bit off, and then you've probably got, what, 500 quid if you're paying flights, 4 or 5 days accommodation.
So you end up minimum, you end up with a grand.
You end up with not a lot for a lot of effort, yeah.
When you think about what some of the other sportsmen get paid for theirs, that's an awful lot of hard work. It's not just race day, but
it's quite good if you're winning. If you're coming first, it's not bad. If you, well, again, that depends on what race you do. Like at Barcelona, it's all right, but say Sweden, for example, winning was $3,000. I don't think anyone's really making a living off that unless they've won it. Like $3,000 in tax in Sweden was 33%. So I got $2,000 minus. I probably got the same as Barcelona, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's not cheap to,
and Sweden was
to hang around
more expensive
in Sweden for a few
Calais,
days,
yeah.
Is it? And so you're netting a grand, maybe 2 grand if you're lucky.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe a little bit more if you can get somebody to cover the cost of your flights or your hotel or help you out there. What about sponsorship? What do you actually get in terms of sponsorship each year?
Yeah, so most of the time it's just...
And by the way, now's kit. A good time to mention all the sponsors.
Yeah, yeah. So most of the time it's just kit, but I think a lot of the thing with sponsorship is the ones who are doing kit, that's what you actually want from them. Like, and they'll develop stuff with you and you're not really too bothered about the money from them. It's nice if they can offer you something financially, but they're the people that you want them to be working on making the kit better so that you can get the results and start earning money that way. I think the best way to get financial sponsorship is from companies that aren't involved in triathlon at all. Like, their whatever motivation they have or whatever exposure they want in that field, they must have some involvement in sport probably to warrant them wanting exposure in triathlon. But they're probably the best way to get like financial sponsorship. I'm lucky in that I've worked with Hoop for a couple of years now, so yeah, they're very good with kit and like happy to help out a bit financially as well.
So you get your wetsuits, do you get your tri kit from Hoop as
yeah,
well?
Yeah, yeah. Every bit of race kit I wear is normally from Hoop, but it's great how they work with people like Dan Bigham and Hoop Watt Bike and stuff to actually develop bits of kit because aerodynamics are so important now. So yeah.
What about your bike?
Yeah, bike, I'm on Reap, so British-based, British-made, which
is... Oh, that's the one that's... Yeah. That's the sort of like the boomerang
side. It's a beam bike, yeah. So it's one of like maybe four beam bikes, something like that. But yeah, it's a fully British-made bike. And the best thing about that is that I can regularly go down to the factory and it's all owned by the same guy who sponsors me. And we can like develop other parts. Like, I know at the minute we're developing like a handlebar system. And it's just stuff like that's more important. Like, financially, I can't buy a company to make a handle, but like, it's just stupid money, isn't it? Like, but if someone can make that for you and provide that bit of kit, the best kit, then that helps massively. Yeah. And then wheels, I'm on Head, which are kind of tested, proven. Steel. Yeah.
Joe's been doing wheels and head wheels for 20 odd years now. He's friends with Dave Flockran at Planet X.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
Based in Door, is he still from his house there?
Yeah. I used to work at a bike shop in Sheffield actually, and I think Joe used to do the wheels from there when it might have even been Zip back then.
Right.
But yeah, I used to work at that shop, so that's how I met Joe. I think people are under this illusion that as a pro triathlete, people approach you all the time and want to just give you stuff and want to be like, oh yeah, we definitely wear our hats or we definitely run in our trainers. It's not. I'm on Head wheels because I've known Joe for years and they're obviously really good wheels. Everyone knows about them, but he's just wanted to help me out as an athlete.
Well, that's the thing about people like Joe and Dave at Planet X and Dino. You know, they're really good at helping people out. They want to help, don't they? They have good companies and it helps their product, but they do want to help people out as well.
Yeah, it's definitely a mix of that. Like, Some of the companies, you can see that they're not going to get a lot off you, but you try and give them as much as you can. But it's just nice people really just stepping in and trying to get you to a point where you can achieve what they believe you can achieve. But you can't do it without these people. That's the thing. Like, there's no way. Like, bikes are the hardest one, I think, to get. Like, no one wants to give you a bike, but without the best bike, you're not going to be anywhere.
Yeah, it's. I think also that particularly age groupers looking in will see people like yourself and they see you winning races. You're doing pretty well now. You've got some traction in the sport. And thinking that you're living a nice, comfortable life. But I mean, I've known a lot of triathletes. You know, we talked about Dan Brooke, and I know Dan would probably have done really well, but he just got. He had some unfortunate luck with race winnings and they didn't pay him and that meant he didn't have the money to see him through the winter and it just deflated him enough to sort of take him away from the sport. It's not an easy life, is it? You're putting a lot of hard work. You're talking about 30 hours a week there, training, that is. That's physically doing the swim, bike, running in the gym.
Yeah, it never sounds that much until you have to get to the sessions as well and get home and do all the other stuff around it.
But you have got to do all the stuff. And if you're talking about, you know, looking for sponsors that are going to give you cash that are outside of the sport, unless you've got a manager doing that searching round, you've got to be marketing yourself. You know, the social media for you probably isn't about going on Facebook and liking something. It's about actually showcasing what you're doing, interacting with people to build a profile.
Yeah, I think interaction is the biggest one. Like, I don't know whether people are scared of it and put like pro triathletes as someone or something that they're not, and then they shy away from it and don't really try and interact. But from people that have, like, I've always been happy to like respond to anyone or answer a question or just talk to people at races. Like, but I think people have this illusion that they can't, or you're not approachable. But yeah, people like investing in the life that we live. I suppose it's just hard to provide that true picture of the life that we actually do live, because social media does rose tint stuff a bit sometimes.
Oh, Instagram. You never see somebody lying on the couch absolutely wasted after day, do you? You always see them out, you know, in the Yorkshire Dales, nice sunny day in this nice sparkly kit, and think this is the life. You don't see the bad side.
Don't scroll back through mine, you might see some of that, but
nights out in Barcelona. We can share your social media at the end, Elliot, so that people can interact with you, because I do think that you know it helps build your profile. I think one of the reasons why someone like Jan Frodeno is so well liked is that he's approachable. You can go and talk to him at races. He's got words and kind words and time to speak to everybody.
Yeah.
People appreciate that. He never seems like he's, I'm too busy, I've got to rush off here. I know for a fact that he remembers people as well. You know, I know for a fact that he's remembered somebody, a friend of mine who was in Kona who helped him in transition a couple of years ago. He remembered them and said hello to them this year.
So he should.
But with all the people I met, it would be easy to get, and particularly the day before your big race, to get wrapped up in your own stuff and forget about all that. And so I think that's what people like. And for people like yourself, where it's, you know, the money's not rolling in. It's not flipping cash machine, is it? There's probably only a dozen or so triathletes in the world that are making a really, you know, nice, comfortable living out of it. Everybody else is struggling to make ends meet.
Yeah, I think it goes above that. I think it's just about being like a genuine person. Like, everything I put out on social media is kind of, it's just me. It's genuine. I'm not going to try and publicize something to give you a different impression or to just, like, I don't know, make my life seem better or something than it is. But again, it's not about like even getting cash from doing that. It's about just, that's the person that I want to be. And that's, if I want to show that, that's what I'll show. That I'll show you what my life is, but only for the reason of being like transparent with it.
I think that's the same with anybody who's working on social media. It's the authenticity, isn't it, that people like, and the integrity.
Mm.
So you've won these two races. Well, not one, you've won one race and you've got an unexpected fourth, which was a bit of a bonus. Assuming you didn't blow all of your prize money on the Sheffield triathlon party the night of the race. Is that enough to see you through the winter now?
It's always touch and go with, like, you kind of live race to race. You try and earn enough money to get you to the next race and keep a bit back, and then again and again and again. And sometimes that fails, because if you do that for a few races in a row and you build a little bit up, then you go to a race and you miss the money and you fall out of it. And then you're like, oh, that, luckily that's only happened to me a few times, but it's only like through my own fault of like DNFing and not finishing races. I've never finished, apart from like Worlds or Europeans, I don't think I've ever finished a major a race out of the prize money, which is probably quite lucky, but it also shows a bit of consistency in that if I am racing, I'm always in the race. Like, I'm always somewhere around. But yeah, it's not enough to fully get through winter. It means that I have to start racing at the beginning of next year and looking to go straight in and pull a result out straight away.
Does that put added pressure onto you, knowing that when you go to a race, you've got to finish in the top three to pay your mortgage? Yeah, otherwise you're going to struggle.
It can do sometimes. It's obviously like, I'm going to spend, what, 6 months training now, 5 months training. If I go to the first race and I'm rubbish, it's because I've got these 5 months wrong. And then you're a bit on the back foot. Then you're like, right, I've just wasted 5 months and maybe I can't turn this round. That adds pressure on, because then if you go to another one and do the same, like, and again, committing to race in other places, like next year, I've committed to race in Texas at the start of the year. So I'll obviously have to invest quite a lot of money to go out to Texas and to stay in Texas, because I'm going to do both the 70.3 and the Ironman out there, which are 3 weeks apart. So it means being in Texas for 3 weeks. If I invest a lot of money in getting out there and staying there and bring no return, then that's quite a big hit at the beginning of the year. But again, it's triathlon and it enables you to travel to these places and do these races.
Is that always at the back of your mind as well then, that this, whilst it's not a lucrative lifestyle and that there's occasional, you know, there's times of struggle, it's giving you a fantastic opportunity to live the dream. And while you have that opportunity, you might as well take it, because the alternative is working in an office. Or...
Absolutely. That's the only reason. When I had the opportunity, I said when I turned pro, I made it sound like I just did one, three races and I was like, right, that was the goal. Let's go and do it. It wasn't like in between there, I had 6 months of university left before I graduated. And it was the point of, right, I can go pro if I want. It'll cost me $900 to get a license of fireman if I'm any good at it. I might not make any of that money back because I might not finish in the prize money. And then what do I do? Like, and I've got no job because I've just finished university. So it was kind of, if I don't do it now, I won't do it in 10 years. I probably won't have the ability to do it in 10 years. So I did it then, even though I knew full well that financially I wasn't going to turn anything back that year, which you're probably not if you go pro for the first few years, to be honest. Like, unless you're really exceptional and right at the top, chances of you building a big enough following, getting enough good race results, and then having people, because it takes time to build relationships with people as well. Like, building enough relationships in a year to then for you to get paid, what, 30 grand a year as a salary or something, or yeah, it's not going to happen, is it? So yeah, I took a risk a couple of years ago and was like, I'm going to do it for me, and it'll give me some good opportunities, because I won't be able to do it in 10 years. Like, if I don't do it now, I won't. And I've got to go to some amazing places through doing it. We're quite lucky that Worlds were in South Africa, like the first year. Well, I actually qualified the year before for Chattanooga. Didn't go because couldn't afford to go to America for a week. Didn't expect to go either. So it was a bit of a shock when I did qualify.
Yeah, and the fact that you can, you know, whilst it's your job, the fact that you can appreciate going to these places is nice to hear, because I guess often... You're sort of in and out, really, aren't you?
It is very in and out. A lot of people like ask you about, oh, how was this place? I was like, I don't know. I flew in on a Friday, I raced on a Sunday, and I flew on Monday morning. Like, I was in the country, but I wasn't really there. Like, all I do the same thing at every single race. I pack my bags up, I put my bike there, I jump in some water, I go for a cycle around some roads and stare at the floor and don't really look at anything, and then try and get through a run in a mental state that's not really fit to appreciate anything around you.
Yeah, you're not really sightseeing, are you, when you're riding 25 miles an hour. So what's the goal with Texas then? Are you looking for, and that's a regional championship, that one, isn't it?
Not anymore. I think they've moved it to the weekend after in St. George, and I'm presuming that's because...
But is St. George an Ironman?
I think there is next year, yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I know the first year in St. George, it was an Ironman.
Was it?
It's altitude and it's quite hilly. Absolutely crucified a lot of people. So
they've done this because Worlds 70.3 in 2021's there, I believe.
Okay.
And I think they're trying to put a bigger race on to make sure it can handle...
So is that for the Ironman or for the
Texas, sorry, we'll start chronologically from the beginning. So 70.3 Texas is...
Is that Texas or Austin?
It's Texas.
Right,
It's Galveston.
Okay.
So 70.3 Texas at the beginning of April. 3 weeks later is Ironman Texas, which is not that far away from Galveston. It's Woodlands, just north of Houston.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I think you can check online, but I think the weekend after, that's now the North American Ironman Champs.
Right.
And I think the bigger race of the, obviously it being a Continental Champs, is to see that the venue and the team can cope with having the 70.3 Worlds the year after, because obviously you'll have a lot more participants at a bigger race.
So going back to that Ironman,
why am I doing it?
is that a Kona hopeful race for you, or just to get another one under your belt?
It's more just to get another one under my belt. There's a reason I'm picking easy, fast courses as well. Because the reason I picked Barcelona or I didn't mind doing it is because even though I am better at hilly races, I didn't want to do a super hilly one and put myself off doing it forever. Like Barcelona, I didn't enjoy any of it, and it's probably one of the easiest courses going. Texas, I hope, is quite similar. It's pretty flat bike, pretty flat run. It normally gets some quick times. I'd rather be racing for 8 hours than 9, 10, 11. But it's just more experience, really. Like, I'm not aiming for Kona. Like, if I qualify, I qualify. But like I say, I've already qualified for New Zealand, which is in... It's the end of November. It's 6 weeks after Kona, so it's a bit of an awkward time if you want to do both. It's not bad doing both the other way around. That said, if I did qualify in Texas, and I probably would go to Kona.
Well, it's a 5-hour flight down to New Zealand from
there. Yeah, it just means being in New Zealand for a long time, which...
Yeah, you definitely wouldn't want to stay in Kona after that. It'd be much cheaper living in New Zealand. Earlier on, before we got started on this conversation, you and I were chatting about, particularly in Ironman, how there is a tendency occasionally for some pros to pull out of a race when things aren't going their way. Let's take the Ironman World Championships. They've got Florida a few weeks later. If you could go to Florida and get some prize money and you're going to finish 20th in Kona and get nothing,
mm-hmm.
you pull out of the run there and then your legs are fresh and you can go to Florida or you can go to Arizona. They get a lot of stick from this from age groupers because, you know, there's a feeling that they should tough it out, that it's disrespecting. And of course, when people like Jan Frodeno struggle on through and finish in 10 hours, and I've seen Pete Jacobs and other guys do it, you know, when things haven't gone their way, they'll point to those guys and say, well, look, if they should do it, you should all be doing it. Please, can you explain from the perspective of somebody for whom this is a living, not a hobby, exactly why somebody might make that decision, what's behind it, the pragmatism and the, you know, the business mentality?
Yeah, I suppose I'm someone that's done it in 70.3 race, and I've pulled out of races because I'm not in the race anymore. And I'm there for a race. I'm there to beat other people and to finish in some prize money as high as possible. I'm not there to get round a 70.3. Like, I know I can, I've done plenty of 70.3s. I know I can get round the distance. It's not a problem. I train to get round that distance as fast as possible, or, well, not even as fast as possible. Normally just 1 second ahead of whoever else is there. That's all you really need to do. If it can be different for age groupers when the whole focus of their year might be that one race, because that's what they need to complete and they want to complete for themselves, and to show that whether they're doing it in 4 hours or 8 hours for a half, like, it's irrelevant. It's, they want to do the best they can for their self-satisfaction. And I think that's the difference. Like, unless they're racing again 2 weeks later, which is unlikely for most age groupers because time constraints, jobs, work, then they're going to battle through even if they get that tactic wrong, just to know that, right, say I aimed 4 hours and I set out on target pace and I blew up and I've ruined it for myself and I've not achieved what I wanted to, but I'm still going to finish because then there is still some achievement in that. Whereas I think that's where the little crossover is to pros. Like, some people think like that. And in Kona, I can understand that. And at World Champs, I can understand that as well. Like, World Champs this year, for me in 20th, I knew I was nowhere. And I just, well, practically, I didn't put as much effort into the run as I would have done if I'd have been involved in the race. Which, so why am I running 30 miles at 90%? You know what I mean? I'm not racing to the finish line. And then you question, well, should I have done that? If, have I just put some extra fatigue into my body? If I'm racing again in 2 weeks, why would I run at 90%? And then again in 2 weeks, I might run at 90% again and I can't access 100% because I'm tired. So I suppose before I have stopped and not ran, just because the running is the most damaging thing. And if I've got a race again in 2 weeks, you never know, if someone turns up and you have to run close to your PB to beat them and you only need 1% extra and you'd done a race 2 weeks before and battled onto the finish line, even if you'd gone steady, like, you've battled on and you've done an extra hour and a bit of exercise, could that have made the difference 2 weeks later?
Mm.
And we're talking, like, it's like with Barcelona. If you win, it's 8,000. If you come second, it's 4. 1% could have just halved how much money you've earned. Like, 8,000 would get you through to next year.
What was the difference between the first and second in terms of time at Barcelona, do you know?
Yeah, it was quite, I think it was maybe 10 minutes. It was, oh, okay. It was got a lot closer after.
Right.
That, because I think I outran both Freddie and I think, yeah, there's only one guy outran me. I think he was behind. I think he was fifth or sixth.
Mm.
So I was catching, but yeah, the gaps were quite big already. But yeah, I think there is a bit of a stigma around DNFing. Like, you're just not trying hard enough. But I think I can vouch for, like, most pros are mentally tough enough to finish whatever you asked them to. Really, if you were like, you've got to knuckle down and do this session, you've got to get through this, I think most of us could probably do it. It's just choosing the times to do it. Like, Sweden this year is probably the hardest mentally what I've had to run, and like, force myself to run that, because I took the lead with like 3 kilometers to go. You can't take the lead with 3k to go and then run easy. You, and they're the hardest races, I think, when you run all the way to the line. And that's what I'm trying to emphasize, like how much of a mess that can make of you.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd accepted that Sweden was the end of my first half of the season. So I had weeks off after it. So it didn't bother me absolutely turning my body inside out to get to that line first. And then, because I knew even if I couldn't walk the next day, I'd have time off. But it's hard to get that motivation if you know you're going to race again in 2 weeks and you're not anywhere near the front.
Well, you've given us a great insight into the life of a professional triathlete, Elliot. Somebody who's trying to find his way in the sport. I hope it continues.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, it'd be great to see you progress, not just through the ranks of the 70.3 pros and, you know, be getting into the top few of the worlds there, but also to see how your next Ironman event is. And,
yeah, Ironman's an interesting one, which I said after Barcelona I probably wasn't going to do, and I suppose a lot of people say this as well, but yeah, I'm already looking at two for next year, so yeah.
Where else are you looking at?
Possibly Vitoria Gasteiz, Northern Spain. Yeah, it's quite a new race, but looks quite good, nice area. Might be a bit hotter as well.
Well, good luck with that one. It's an interesting journey. It's not all about getting to Kona. That is getting to the World Championship sort of, you know, shows where you are in the pecking order, doesn't it? But it's, you know, if you're also interested in going to see other parts of the world, then there's something else you can get out of the sport as well.
Yeah, I don't think I'm in the camp of Kona being so mystical to me yet. I think this comes with like I said earlier about not understanding why people don't run faster. I think it's to most people, Kona's like the pinnacle of the sport and it will be no better. But yeah, I don't think I'm quite there yet. Maybe I will be one day if I ever experience it and go there.
Well, as I said, best wishes with that, Elliot. I really appreciate you coming in to chat
no
today.
Problem. Thank you.
We'll make sure we give people links to your social media. We'll give your sponsors a mention and maybe put some links to them as well in the show notes.
Yeah, go and check them out.
And enjoy the rest of your winter.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks, Elliot. Right then, that's a wrap for this week. Thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe you'd be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.